Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Alice McDermott. Her most recent novel is called Someone. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And let me begin by saying that I love this book about as much as I can imagine loving a novel. It was really, for me, delicious, warm, sort of, you'll pardon me, a salvation. It provided a lot of balm for very unhappy areas. You know, in other words, the things that I've always turned to novels for and rarely find solace first, and a sense that solace is impossible.
Both at once.
Both at once.
Yes. Yeah.
Because the young woman who narrates this book, Marie, at a certain point, well, she doesn't want to work in Manhattan. She lives in Brooklyn with her mother and her brother. And she gets an unusual job in which solace is a requirement. Tell
yes,
about it.
Yes. She is the consoling angel for Fagin's funeral parlor, which is in a brownstone not too far from where Marie lives in an apartment with her mother and brother, as you say. And her job is to greet the mourners and take coats and be a pretty face. That's the way Fagin sees it, an idea he borrows from Dickens, and having a child mourner at every funeral to remind people of life again, and as he says it, which is also the hope of resurrection.
And he asks her, Fagin asks Marie, will she go upstairs from time to time and talk to his mother? His mother once was in the business, one assumes, might have been a consoling angel herself once.
Right.
She's now old, and she's visited all the time by nuns and charity nurses. She's surrounded by women who know the bodies in this neighborhood when they were once walking, talking human beings.
Yes, yes.
And they have a whole system of secret signs for telling the inner truth. For instance,
well, I mean, it's they, when Marie comes up to visit, their question is, "What's going on downstairs?" And she and Marie will name for them who's being waked in the parlor downstairs, and then Mrs. Fagin and her friends, as you say, nuns and nurses, old women from the neighborhood, will begin to piece together a biography for the newly dead. And of course, since in this era and among these people and in any life, there are parts of the life that either they have no words for or they are delicate about using the words, they have this series of to pantomime a flask raised to the lips means that he had a problem with alcohol. To rub forefinger and thumb together means he was cheap or she was cheap. There was money there.
Stingy.
Right. Right. So a biography is made, but also you know, paying homage to what should not be spoken of, even of the dead. That they understand, and that Marie comes to understand, but awkward words never cross their lips, although yet a whole story is created.
Now, this is an Irish neighborhood. The book begins, what year would you say?
Oh, about 1920, early 1920s, yeah.
So we go through the consequences of the Depression. We go through World War.
Yes.
We go up to and beyond Vietnam. this is going to end when Marie is an old lady.
Yes, yeah.
And if it has been the nature of her life and her brother's life and her mother's life to see that others are not alone when they die,
right.
She is alone, or at least conventionally alone, but still true to Marie form, there's someone in the hospice,
yes,
to tell stories to lift her back into the bed if she'll only ask.
Yes,
but
right.
She's a bold piece.
She's
her
a
mother's.
Bold piece, right? Yeah. And she's a little pagan, as her father called her. To ask for help, to ask for hope, to ask for redemption, to ask for solace. Takes a certain amount of courage. But she does have, and I'm so glad that, you know, that you referred to that, because it's a very short scene, but it is the last scene of her life, although it's not chronologically narrated. And there is a kind of consoling angel with her. He's just a caregiver. And
she says, if you're a caregiver, she thinks, am I a caretaker?
A caretaker, right, yes, yeah, right. Yeah.
And it is, to my mind, magnificent that once again you return to this little arc, the arc between Brooklyn and Regal mm-hmm. Park, Queens, and it's the space that is occupied by all of these books. What gives it its continuous life for you? How do you write about this patch so consistently and so differently every time?
Well, I guess that what keeps me going is that I do see it differently every time, and the world, the geographical world of this novel, of someone and of Marie's life, is very different, or at least I see its role in the novel as very different from Charming Billy or That Night. And for me, I mean, the goal for this novel was to somehow trace that arc of life of a character who was not heard from much in her own life, is not heard from much in literature, and to give the novel entirely over to her voice, so that it's not, I'm not so interested in real estate values in Brooklyn from 1920 to 2010, although that's a fascinating subject, but it's more what Marie sees when she looks out of her myopic eyes, and that world is, because it's Marie's world, is, even though on a map it's the same place, it's a very different world from the world that appeared in those other novels. This is Marie's emotional world first, and everything about the place that I've made use of is made use of to illuminate her interior life.
Now, Alice McDermott has written 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 previous novels. Among them, after this, Child of My Heart, Charming Billy. Well, I love them all. And as usual, the narrative is organized so that it constantly refracts itself. Marie, yes, she's someone who hasn't been heard from by literature, but in the book, a body comes, a woman who's been a cleaning lady at a rectory.
Mm-hmm.
Her brother is a big fancy bishop.
Right.
He's bought her a dress from Saks Fifth Avenue. Beautiful blue dress. The first dress we see in this book, by the way, is blue on the first page. And but it's too big for her. Her illness has whittled
body
her
has
down
been
to
whittled,
bone.
Yes. Yeah.
He drops by, but leaves the praying to his inferiors
mm-hmm.
to handle. And he hasn't seen her in all these years.
Right.
Marie is someone who Alice McDermott will not treat the way the bishop treated his sister. That this is not just attention must be paid, it's not clear that it must be paid. Attention can be paid.
Yes. it scared me. This book scared me to death in the single-mindedness of the voice. I mean, there were times when I told myself, you know, there are lots of fascinating men in this novel. Maybe I should give a couple of them a chapter or two. her husband was a prisoner of war. I could throw that in, and then everybody would see, wow, I can do lots of things. But my first intention for the novel and the thing that I had to be true to was that it would be only her life and her way of seeing, her way of missing seeing, and also the things that she captures that maybe we miss as well.
I'm talking to Alice McDermott about her wonderful new novel, Someone. That title seems to come, Marie has had her heart broken, and she asks her brother, who's briefly been in the seminary, but not long, she says, who will love me? And he says, someone.
Someone will. Yeah. Not terribly convincingly at
no.
that moment. Right.
Well, it can never be convincing.
No.
He knows that the solution is not to describe the person who can be found. He says, the solution is to take a walk.
Yes, yes. It's all by walking.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's very moving because the neighborhood is the solution in a certain sense, or they thought it was.
Yes.
And they thought they'd spend their whole lives there, but the neighborhood changed.
Yes, out from under them. And there's another refrain of the title earlier when Marie has been, as a seven-year-old, has been given the Irish word Amadon by a neighbor girl, Peggyn Shahab, which means fool. And Peggyn falls down the stairs and dies at 17, a very brief and ordinary life herself. Her parents, Marie and her brother and her parents, go to the wake next door. And when they come home, Gabe, her brother, who's bound for the seminary and recites poetry, is the golden Irish son, Irish-American son, picks up the Bible and he reads to his parents the lines from Matthew about are not two sparrows sold for a small coin, and yet not one of them falls to the ground without your father's notice. Even the hairs on your head are counted. You are worth more than many sparrows. And he reads that to his parents, and Marie, mostly because she's so tired of him getting all the attention at the dining room table, responds, Amadon, fool. And when her mother picks her up and brings her into the bathroom and washes her mouth out with soap for for her impiety, Gabe says to the father, what does it mean, Amadon? And Marie's father said, it means someone's a fool. And it's that tension between that outrageous proposition that we are worth more than many sparrows in light of an ordinary 17-year-old whose brief life ended. Who was paying attention to that? Who watched her fall? What an outrageous proposal that is, especially in light of the, but for anybody who is aware and lives and understands our mortality. And yet it's proposed. It offers some comfort. And Marie undercuts it with, but you're a fool to believe that. And in so many ways, I discovered that the arc of the novel was the tension between those two things. Even not so much the belief in the proposition, but even to make the proposition.
Now, you've explained to me magnificently how previous novels have been structured by the rosary, say, or acts of grace. What is the inner structure of this? Because I had the feeling in the very first chapter, you talk about the first darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot about coming from darkness and the echo of a slap, first the slap and then
yes.
its echo pain.
Yes. Yes.
And I wondered if you could tell me more about how the book is shaped, because I think that all your books have an accounting for the hair of the sparrow.
Yes.
And that they are testament to the belief that the novelist is enacting something previously demonstrated by the God of the scripture.
Yes, and I think that's not something that I can say honestly that I brought to the composition of the novel. This was very much a novel that revealed its structure to me. And I guess what I brought was the search to look for, over the arc of this life, those moments that resonate, those moments that reveal something other than what they are. So, dealing with memory, as you say, the echo of the slap, the recalled phrase, the repetition across time, so things that begin to seem to have a meaning outside of their apparent meaning don't arrive in a flash at any point in poor Marie's life, but in an accumulation of small revelations that speak to what I think of as the argument, the tension between being a fool and being faithful.
Mm. Being a fool and being someone, too.
And being someone, yes.
That
yes.
amazes me. What an idea that in the absence of someone, one falls into foolishness.
Yes, yeah.
Amazing. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Alice McDermott about her book, Someone. We'll continue after this short break.
This is Connie Alvarez. Bookworm is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station in Los Angeles. It costs money to put this program together. Please help support us by going to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Alice McDermott about her new and really wonderful book, Someone, a novel in which the old cliché, everyone has a story, is revealed in all of its quotidian profundity. You know, there have always been sections of Alice McDermott's novels that are like pure bliss. I remember recognizing this in her second book, That Night, in which a bunch of girls, children, boys and girls, are talking about what they think they know about sex and trying to put it together. And it's hilarious. Well, this book has sections that are as funny as that, and sadnesses, and the punctuation, almost, you know, understanding that joy and sorrow can't be orchestrated meaningfully. They just come and go.
Exactly. Yes. And thank you for that, because I'm just realizing, talking about falling and dying in funeral parlors.
You'd never know how funny this book is, and right. It sometimes
thank
made
you.
Me
right.
laugh out loud.
Right. And the thing, you know, that it's all tied together. You know, I mean, it's. I've thought of the line from Yeats before with other novels, but that wonderful line that under every dancer a dead man in his grave, that both things are, we're living and we're dying simultaneously, and it's all part of the fabric, and you can't have one without, you can't have the light without the dark. You can't have love without foolishness. They're all together, and to separate them is to be inauthentic.
Well, it occurred to me that, for lack of a more beautiful word, the biddies upstairs are grown-up versions of the children in the street.
Yes.
Just as they, in That Night, were talking about the sex they don't know about, these are women older now, anticipating death and telling us what they know about life.
Yes.
That it boils down to, he had a problem drinking. He couldn't stop loving her.
Right.
You know, he
right.
was stingy. She
right.
was stingy.
Right.
And they have signs that have made words unnecessary.
Yes.
And the young woman, Marie, our narrator, is watching them. And they can't look at her. She has problems seeing. But they're so, the nuns, they have to twist and look around their wimples in order to see her.
To make sure she's listening.
And, you know, that scene of instruction without anyone saying, now don't ever forget this.
Yes,
but they do wave their fingers goodness. Around
oh,
a lot.
Oh, my goodness. Well, the bishop's sister who gets the beautiful blue suit from Saks Fifth Avenue to wear in her coffin that, of course, doesn't fit her. When Mrs. Fagan tells that story and Marie is there, and of course, all the women know what a horrible man this bishop is and what he missed and who the great person in these brother and sister, who's the great person and who's the one who should be ashamed of himself, as they would have said. But all she has to say when Marie, defending the bishop because he was beautiful and he was the cleanest man she'd ever seen and he was elegant and he had a really good-looking secretary, male priest secretary following him, and the suit was beautiful and her breath is taken away just by the glory of it. And all Mrs. Fagan has to say is, Saks Fifth Avenue, no less. And Marie sees, I've been a fool. I've been taken in by baubles.
Yeah,
the instruction. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you see, it's not just the bishop who should be ashamed of himself. There's an eye doctor who operates on the wrong eye. He's turned his practice into such a mill.
Yes, yeah.
And men in general are people who should be ashamed of themselves in this book. How did that happen?
You know, someone said to me, you know, the priests don't come off very well in this novel. And I said, well, they come off better than the doctors. <You know? laughs> And then I found out the man who asked that question was a doctor, you know. But I think it comes to, you know, Marie, part of it is the era. Part of it is being a woman with glasses, not particularly attractive, small of stature, at this time and this place. She's not being much noticed, but there's that. But I think also that these are the people, doctors and the priests, those male professions at the time and still, these are the people who are missing her. And not only are they missing her, they're missing the lives of the women that they are supposedly there to serve. There's that sense with the doctor of, as you say, the mill. There's no individual patient. There's no real human being in that waiting room. He says the exact same thing as he comes out to check in with whoever's the relative who's in the waiting room. Says the same thing over and over again with no awareness that everybody's hearing him say it.
Am I correct in thinking that as she grows older and has children, that those children regard Marie in a way the way the doctor does? She's someone who has to be born and seen and taken mm-hmm. over to the doctor, mm-hmm. and an old age home needs to be found. But it's just in a day's work. It's
not
a tender passion.
Yeah.
And she says to them, I saw a different world than you. And again, the emphasis on seeing.
Right.
And that seeing is not literal seeing. Seeing is inner seeing. And that some of the men she's attracted to wore thickened shoes. She wasn't mm-hmm. afraid of the halt or the lame. Mm-hmm. She had an instinct mm-hmm. of what moved her. And her daughters seemed to be unmoved. Sign of the times, or?
Well, again, I think it's the rushing world, too. I think it's, and again, part of it plays against that sense, you know, a sparrow doesn't fall without your father seeing, but we're missing each other all the time. You know, there is a sense of accepting that most of the people who surround us are generic in some way. And Marie certainly would have been seen that way. So that doesn't mean that there's a lack of love. It doesn't mean that and it goes back to what you said, attention does not need to be paid. We can go through our lives very successfully without paying attention in that way.
So would you say that special kind of attention that does not need to be paid is the novelist's attention?
Certainly. And well, it's it And it's attention to the life and to the world of the life. And that's where the careful examination, the close examination of this unextraordinary life, or any life, that which is what the novelist does, you know, that stopping time with a detail to see it clearly, not just to record it, not just so that we know what it was like to be such a woman living at such a time, but to look at it carefully enough so that if there is something within it that shows us what we can't see in our daily lives, that hint of another world, that hint of solace, that hint of a benevolence that counts every hair on our head, that can be delivered to our eyes, even briefly, not with a great flash and a leap of faith, but somehow, and I guess this is my belief, it's there. It's in the fabric of life if we look at it the right way. There are more things to be seen than we know of in any life. And I think it's the novelist's job to reproduce that life in such a way that we get a hint of that, even if we don't have any words for it.
I am so pleased that finally so many critics and readers are starting to recognize how much is in your novels, how deeply and densely they're packed. And yet I think, as usual, they're getting it all wrong. This is the novel that you can just read for comfort and joy. And I'll tell you, for me, reading the book made me less afraid.
Oh.
It's always really a pleasure to see you.
Same here. Thanks, Michael.
I've been talking with Alice McDermott, author most recently of Someone, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Robert Dewhurst. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Alan Gurgenis is our guest.